Well, beloved listeners, as Australia was rushing towards its centenary of federation, Joan Kerner was given the job by COAG, that unfortunate term for the Council of Australian Governments, to see what it was we should actually be celebrating. And I was Joan's aide-de-camp. And so we wandered around Australia. We went to every town hall from coast to coast. We spoke to the CWA, we spoke to the RSL, we spoke to the Boy Scouts, we spoke to anyone and everyone. They came in to do their pitch on the celebration of the centenary of federation. And we always ask the same question: what is it we should be celebrating? And the universal answer was our tolerance. We seem to believe that we're unique in being incredibly tolerant. Now, Joan and I would look at each other and roll our eyes with memories of white Australia, with the treatment of the Indigenous population. But nonetheless, that's what everyone wanted to believe. So that was the basis of our report to government. But between the time we signed off on it and the centenary, along came the One Nation phenomenon, proving it was all absolute and utter twaddle. Hugh Mackay wrote that myths may often seem benign, that they can be a great source of comfort. But he also said they can weaken us by blinding us to the way things really are. We can take refuge in myth, anaesthetise ourselves, insulate ourselves from reality. And now it's time to introduce another woman premier. In fact, the first woman to ever be the premier of an Australian state. My old friend Carmen Lawrence. And Carmen is tackling another national myth, and that is that we are a great believer in equality. And it's terrific, after a long absence, to welcome Carmen back to the program. How's things in Margaret River?
Beautiful, thank you. Yes, I've been down here in a very privileged position. In fact, it's somewhat interesting that I'm talking about inequality when I'm one of the people who benefits and has benefited from the wealth of this nation.
Well, the notion of the fair go, our endless stressing of mateship, quintessentially Australian. You point out that, in fact, it's almost a universal myth that most nations seem to share.
That's right. If you look around the world, and there is, you know, these global surveys that are undertaken from time to time, it's very clear that we're not unique in that respect and endorsing the idea of equality of opportunity, of tolerance, you know, in various forms, ensuring that equality exists in society. I guess where countries differ is the extent to which that's a very formal requirement. So you have anti-discrimination legislation, for instance, and certain institutions that protect the equal treatment of citizens, or what others have described as a more substantive form of addressing inequality, which says, look, let's look at the fact that there is inequality and what can we do to diminish it. It's a much more, as I've said in the essay, muscular form of intervention.
So on one hand, we've got formal equality, which is, you know, pious statements and even the odd bit of legislation.
That's right.
But you want to move the attention onto the real outcomes of working towards an actual equality.
That's right. So it's equality of outcome rather than just the equality of opportunity. I mean, I love the response of Martin Luther King, admittedly, you know, not an Australian, but someone said to him in his career, obviously advocating for African Americans, people should pull themselves up by their bootstraps, he was told. And he said, first you've got to have boots. And I thought that's a very obvious way of responding to that intervention, but one that most of us wouldn't have thought about.
You instance quite a few countries who do the job at least as well as us and often a lot better.
Yes.
But very few countries require people to sign a value statement, an Australian value statement in our case, on arrival.
That's right.
And as I reread it, it seemed to me that a great many people born here with generations of connections to Australia wouldn't really be able to honestly sign up for that value statement.
No, that's right. And that's something that's become, in a sense, firmer with every iteration. But it's not necessarily the case that Australians would immediately be able to, hand on heart, say that they are signed up to all of those values that our migrants have to commit to. But again, it's not a statement that's really all that different from that of many other nations. And I've pointed to, for instance, Norway, not because we always want to sort of sit in behind and say the Scandinavian countries are the best, but just because it's fairly typical, you know, that everybody says that that's important.
You cited Martin Luther King. You also quote Lyndon Johnson, who explained in a 1965 speech about equal opportunity, you do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberating, bringing out to the starting line of a race, and then say you are free to compete with all the others and still believe that you've been completely fair. And that overwhelmingly, painfully, agonisingly, tragically, of course, applies to Australia's Indigenous population.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting that a lot of Australians will sign up for the idea that we really should get involved in redistribution of wealth and trying to do something about the gaps. And I was a panel member of the Gonski Review, and that was directed particularly at trying to reduce those gaps in education. So you acknowledge that people approach the school door with considerable disadvantages, and that if you were really going to provide anything remotely resembling equality, you had to address those disadvantages and not continue, in a sense, to reward those who already had with more. And Indigenous Australians are in the, I suppose, a very iniquitous position that attitudes toward them mean that in the very few occasions where they do get additional resources to try and address and redress that disadvantage, there's often a very strong negative response to that.
Well, Pauline Hanson exploited that,
exactly,
that deep prejudice and that massive misinformation.
That's right. And the idea that, you know, somehow they're getting all these ridiculous interventions to try and protect them from living in the 21st century, when in reality there is far too little in the way of support for reducing Indigenous disadvantage, you know, whether it's in education or health, poorer services, poorer schools, you know, poorer everything. Instead of getting more to redress the disadvantage, in fact, the reality is they get less.
Once upon a time, egalitarianism, at least amongst white folk, was more tangible in our country, whether you were the boss or worker, everyone was, you know, was basically equal. Do you think the growth of the middle class, especially after World War II, was when things perhaps began to change?
I'm not sure about that. We certainly had a more obvious equality in that what some people, you know, almost nostalgically kind of point to as a golden age where inequality was relatively low and participation generally for all citizens and the redressing of disadvantage was more obviously in there. I mean, whether you look at our tax system or our industrial relations system, the idea that, you know, Jack was as good as his master, I think, became a very strong view amongst both policymakers and people generally. But with the changes to so-called neoliberalism, the idea that, you know, things would trickle down and you didn't need to have those institutions, indeed they were a handicap to economic growth, that gradually that the less well-off found themselves, relatively speaking, even worse off. And in the middle classes, now the pressure is on, and I think that's where a lot of the reaction is coming, not just in Australia, but also globally.
Well, talking about globally, the gap in equality is a global political problem, and it's becoming a louder issue at every election as more and more people around the world deeply resent the gap.
Yes. 15 years ago, even when this inequality was on the move, you couldn't get an argument about it. I mean, I tried, many others tried, to point to the fact that in Australia and globally, we were heading in the wrong direction and that there were likely to be prices to be paid if inequality continued to widen. And now we're seeing those prices being paid, you know, in social conflict, in lack of trust in democracy, all of those sorts of things we know are associated with growing inequality, and we're now reaping the whirlwind.
Carmen, you note that the World Bank acknowledges that inequality jeopardises economic growth and the reduction of poverty, and it's possible that it drives conflicts and destabilises society, so inequality is not just a moral issue.
Not at all. I mean, and the consequences, you know, its causal connections are difficult to establish, obviously, in this work, because you're comparing nations with themselves in the past or nations with one another or you know, in big countries like the United States, states with one another. But it's very clear that where you have wide inequality, you also have a whole catalogue of social ills. And the problem for Australia is that we sit at the wrong end of the, if you like, the developed country league table. So we have, you know, bigger gender gap in pay, for example, but wider inequality generally, and we have more health and social problems, including, people would be surprised to know, amongst the least generous policies directed toward families and children. And as a result, and it's not due to the Indigenous problems, we have higher rates of childhood mortality than some countries. And there's a very significant price that we pay for this, which a lot of people really don't, I think, understand.
So the drag of inequality is particularly obvious in the deepening impact of social disadvantage on children's educational chances, hence your role in Gonski.
Yes, I mean, it was very clear, and it was interesting. The panel, if you looked at the makeup of it, you know, was across the political spectrum, and people that had, you know, strong experience with private schools or government schools, as in my case, you know, as a minister. And we could not second-guess the evidence, which showed very clearly that the children who were most in need had least of the resources, had fewer of the resources that Australia had to offer, and that was growing. And that parents' position, both in terms of their income and their own education, was a much stronger predictor of children's fate, if you like, in Australia than it was in many other countries. So clearly we could do a lot better by redistributing those funds. We didn't argue for an increase, by the way, initially, but redistribute the funds, a politically difficult thing to do, toward those schools that had a large number of children with disadvantage because of their socioeconomic status or Indigenous background or disability, but also to put more money where there was concentrations of disadvantage, because that's obviously one of the other things that happens, that over time people tend to be concentrated in the most disadvantaged areas and most disadvantaged schools, and that compounds the problem.
Carmen, you must be thrilled to bits at the enormous political success of the Gonski report.
Tragic, really, isn't it? Ken Boston, I think, has very clearly outlined the extent to which what has been implemented, probably most closely to the Gonski recommendations in New South Wales, but does fall far short of what was proposed, and that the advantage that accrues to the wealthier schools, that are typically independent but not exclusively, has continued to grow. Australia is in the awkward position of, as I say, espousing these views about equality while at the same time making it worse.
We have returned to that contrarian document, the Honest History Book, and I'm talking to Carmen Lawrence about her contribution to a series of very provocative essays. Hers is called Fair Go Nation? You say that in Australia we've progressively neutered many of the instruments designed to spread wealth more evenly.
Yes, I mean, one of them is education. I know when I was growing up, I went to a little Catholic private school in the bush. In fact, at that time, they were the schools that were disadvantaged because they had very little in the way of income. But government schools and government school systems were held in high esteem, and kids could come from a family where there'd been very little education and they didn't have a lot of wealth and aspire to outcomes that were really superior. What we've done over time, by the way we funded education, for example, is to turn that on its head. And that's the sort of issue that I'm talking about. But also in income tax, in social housing, you know, we've lots of discussions now about the fact that young people can't afford housing. But we have high levels of homelessness as well, where people can't get a home at all and where people in crisis can't find adequate housing. But there's also no housing for people on low incomes who are forced into a very unstable rental market. If anyone's tried to rent a property, they'll know that it's not something you would choose to do in Australia. So even having decent legislation to control the behaviour of landlords and improve the outcomes for renters would be a return, or maybe for the first time, an embrace of something that would make life much more bearable and allow people to use more of their income for other purposes.
Now, Carmen, I have reappointed you both Premier and Prime Minister, so you're going to be a bit busy.
Bit busy, yes.
What are we going to do about it?
Well, I think we need to go back almost to first principles and ask the question of every piece of legislation, What is the social impact of this legislation? How does it feed into our aspiration to be a fair go society? Does it make it harder? For instance, if we strip away the protection for low-income earners, you know, through the industrial relations system, make it easier for them to be exploited, have employers fail to pay their superannuation? All of these scandals have emerged in recent times because there's a sense that government shouldn't interfere in the market, which I find the most extraordinary proposition, given that the market is a construction of the state. So I think there's an argument to be made that we should be much more attentive to every piece of legislation, you know, whether it purports to be about regulation or about education or health. How does this affect the least well-off in our community? And surely, you know, how can we improve the outcomes? So it's an across-the-board, I think, re-examination of a lot of legislation that sneaks through, and before we know it, we've got all sorts of unlooked-for outcomes. I'm not saying it's, you know, it is often something that hasn't been anticipated.
Is there any possibility that you get a useful or a sufficient degree of bipartisan agreement?
Well, as you know, Philip, and you talk to a lot of the people about these questions, there's a toxic degree of antipathy between the major parties at the moment.
And within them.
Yes. I mean, I'm always reminded of Freud when he was talking about some of the differences between people who were actually very similar. And he talked about it being a form of narcissism, you know, that this is the only way you can distinguish yourself, by making a great deal of fuss about minor differences. He called it the narcissism of minor differences, and I think we're stuck in that at the moment.
And yet, as we look around the world, we see the catastrophic political consequences of getting it wrong.
That's absolutely right. I mean, all of these effects lead to a lack of trust in government, a lack of willingness of people to cooperate with one another, and we know that high levels of inequality are linked to more corruption in government, greater exploitation of workers, and so on. So these are all things that I would hope that the major political parties, quite apart from the, as I say, the minor differences in their ideologies, in reality, would focus on the needs of their citizens. I mean, they often say that they want to put the interests of Australians first. Well, demonstrate it.
I think we've demonstrated in our little chat that we live by delusions. One of them is that we're the most tolerant of people, and the other is that we're the most egalitarian. I thank you, Carmen. Dr. Carmen Lawrence, former Premier of WA, Federal Labor Minister in the Keating government, and Carmen's now at the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Western Australia. Blessings upon you, Carmen.
Thank you, Philip.